I'm Artie Moscowane. Welcome to Radio Times. There are many delightful and surprising anecdotes in Stephen Johnson's new book, Wonderland, How Play Made the Modern World. One intriguing story involved Jacques de Vaucanson. He was a skilled 18th century automaton designer who built a flute-playing shepherd and a, quote, digesting duck that entertained passersby on the streets of Paris. That invention led Vaucanson to the idea of a loom programmed to create intricate silk patterns using cylinders. Well, that had big problems, but it inspired another Frenchman, Joseph-Marie Jacquard, who designed a successful loom that transformed textile production. Johnson's book is how the delight and wonder of play and entertainment have led to unexpected innovations and technologies that have shaped our world. His previous books include Where Good Ideas Come From, Future Perfect, Everything Bad is Good for You, How We Got to Now, which was developed into a PBS series which he hosted and co-created, and Stephen Johnson joins us from the NPR studios in New York City, and nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Yeah, it's great to be back. I'm glad you started with the digesting duck. That's always a good place to begin.
I could not resist, to tell you the truth. But let me see if I can pull together some of the themes in your books. And it seems that you are on a mission, if I can put it that way, to give play the kind of respect it deserves. True? Not true?
Yeah, I mean, this does connect back to a book I wrote more than 10 years ago, which I think maybe we even talked about years ago, called Everything Bad is Good for You, which
Absolutely.
Was a kind of a defense of popular culture that was kind of making the argument that a lot of the things we thought of as frivolous and modern entertainment were actually making us smarter on some level, and particularly games. It was really – a lot of that book was a defense of video games, which had been – derided as being a complete waste of time or worse, that they were kind of warping the minds of another generation. And I tried in that book to make a kind of a present tense argument for why games had actually gotten very interesting and they were very challenging and that we should be less concerned about them actually. Of course, since I wrote that book, I now have teenage children.
And we could do a whole hour on
I've
part two
everything.
On that.
Yeah, exactly.
Exactly.
But what Wonderland picks up on that theme but tries to look at it historically, really,
right.
And to make the argument not just in terms of kind of present tense media, but in fact through a much longer kind of time span. In fact, parts of the book go back 50,000 years.
And I do want to go back to that, but let's talk a little bit about play. And I have to say, as I was reading your book, I was thinking about when our son was little and kids play. I mean, in many ways, little kids are scientists, they're explorers, they're philosophers. They know how to play like nobody else. When you talk about play, is that how you think about it?
Yeah. There are a couple of things that are worth saying. First off, in the book, the word play and the concept I'm talking about is slightly larger, I would say, than the traditional sense of kind of child's play or
right.
game play. That is certainly part of it, and there's a whole chapter on the history of games. But it includes things that we really the broader definition is things that we don't have to do, but that we do because they're fun or delightful or surprising or amusing in some way. So games are a great example of that, but so is fashion, for instance, or so are optical illusions. They aren't functional in some clear way. They don't give us, you know, they don't protect us against predators or against disease or, you know, directly help us reproduce our species. You know, they're just these kind of frills. And so I put all of that under, I wanted to have a single word to describe that. And that word became play because that was really, I thought, the most evocative one. But it does include a couple of other things. But that childhood instinct for play is very important because it shows that this appetite for kind of delight and kind of the playful exploration is a profound part of who we are as a species. And in fact, there seems to be a lot of evidence that animals that have display a lot of play-like behavior in early childhood tend to be, when they grow up, the most kind of resilient, adaptive, creative, problem-solving species. And human beings just have the longest kind of childhood playtime of any animals. And so there seems to be a connection between creativity, imagination, and play that is borne out by the kind of historical studies that I look at in the book.
Well, let's go back to Baghdad. Let's go back to the 18th century. There were these three brothers known as Banu Musa, and they wrote a book called The Book of Ingenious Devices. I mean, a really a fascinating description, I guess, of the playthings of the time or how they thought about invention and play.
Yeah, 8th century, not 18th century. So we're going
back. Oh, 8th century, absolutely.
Yeah. We're going back almost
way back.
1,200 years. And this is really at the height of the Islamic Golden Age. And Baghdad at this point is arguably the most advanced city in the world, certainly the seat of some of the most advanced scholarship in the world. And there's this, as you say, kind of amazing institution there called the House of Wisdom, which I think is a great name for an institution. And it was kind of like a little bit of a think tank and a translation bureau. But it was also, I guess we would call it now almost like a maker lab. And it was filled with these interesting engineers who were kind of designing, you know, cool objects using the most advanced technology of the day. And there were a number of them, but there were these three brothers that are now known as the Banu Musa. And they published a number of books illustrating their inventions. And these inventions involved absolutely state-of-the-art engineering techniques. So they had water clocks that were more accurate than anything Europe would see for hundreds of years. They were flow regulators that we now would use in kind of hydraulic systems. There was a float valves and all these, you know, kind of complicated engineering techniques or devices. But if you look at what they were actually building using all this advanced technology, almost all of it was toys.
Yeah.
There was, you know, a little robotic peacock that you could kind of pull on its feathers and it would give you water, and the little man would pop out and give you a little bit of soap. Or there was an elephant clock, and there were little fountains that would spout water and rhythm, and there were lots of musical toys. And so you had this interesting thing, and you can see their diagrams, beautiful full-color diagrams that we reproduced in the book. And you see this interesting combination of some of the most advanced engineering in the world at that point, all in the service of toys.
Well, it's interesting.
And that was very kind of telling and that's actually kind of the opening scene in a sense of the book.
It absolutely is. And there are certain themes here. The music box begets, you know, other inventions that begets other inventions. And if you follow the path that you have laid, leads in many ways to the computers that we use today.
Well, yeah, that's the other thing that the book. This is what I've started doing.
It's a big sprawling book, I should say. But go ahead.
Well, you know, this is something like how. Yeah, that's right. You were giving spoiler alert. Where this is all
here
going?
We go.
No. This is the fun of these books. How we got to Now, the last one was like this too, where you kind of follow. You start somewhere and then you know, 10 pages later, you end up with something that seems totally different, but you know, it turns out there's a direct causal link between them. And so, one of the other things that the Banu Musa did in Baghdad is they invented this device, which we almost lost record of, actually. We only found a manuscript describing it about 100 years ago. It almost kind of disappeared. But they invented this device called the instrument that plays itself. And it was basically an automated flute player that was kind of behind the scenes. It was really an organ. But you could take this little robot that would make it look like he was playing a flute. But what made this device so radical is that you could control the notes that were played by the organ using this rotating metallic cylinder, which you alluded to in the opening. And basically, it looked like a music box in the sense that you had little pins on the cylinder that corresponded to the notes that you wanted to play and the length of the notes that you wanted to play. But the radical idea was you could take out that cylinder and create a new one with a different set of notes and put it back in the machine, and it would play a completely different song. And the Banu Musa were very proud of this innovation, and they spent a lot of time in the description of it describing how you could cut a new cylinder if you wanted to create a new song. And what this really meant was this was arguably the first programmable machine in the history of the world. It was the first machine that wasn't just designed to do one thing but was open-ended in what it could do. And if you wanted to create some new function for it, you just created new code and inserted the code in the machine, and it would behave in this kind of new fashion. And that is really the beginning between hardware And software, the whole idea of programmability, comes out of this creation. But it, again, it was not functional. It was just – it was a toy. It was music. And that stays alive basically in the world of music. That radical idea of programmability stays alive in music through music boxes, makes it all the way to Vaucanson, as you said, who started to think about it in terms of looms and textile production. It gets modified by Jacquard, as you said. And Jacquard's big idea was that you could program not with these cylinders but with paper punched cards. Mm. This was the big breakthrough because a cylinder was too repetitive. It was just a circle. And so the patterns were very simple. But a stack of cards, you could just have an infinite number of patterns. And it was much easier to kind of repunch them and create a new code. And the punch card, one, was very important for textile production. But that was what inspired the first generation of computer designers. And in fact, punch cards were used to program computers up until the 1970s. I mean, I'm old enough to remember.
Me too.
You know, as a second grader in our school, we got a computer and there were these little punch cards. Right. And so there is a direct connection between these Baghdad engineers dreaming up this, you know, automated flute player and the modern computer. And I think that's kind of – it's important to remember this because – so often we think of the story of computers as being, oh, we got computers because we had to win World War II and we had to crack the Enigma code and we had to calculate rocket trajectories. And so it took a big military, you know, engagement to get us to think about code and computation in this way, which is a huge part of the story. I mean, I'm not denying that that was not important. But there's also this creative and musical and playful side to that story that is just as important.
Well, I mentioned the digesting duck, I guess also known as the defecating duck. I didn't want to say that in my introduction.
I'm glad you kept it clean
I kept
a while,
it kind of clean, at least until now. I mean, how advanced was de Vaucanson's digesting duck? We have about a minute before our first break here, Stephen.
Yeah, so this is what they used to do in Paris. You know, they would hang out in these elite drawing rooms and they would look at these automatons. And one of them was this digesting duck. And basically, it was kind of this anatomically correct duck that could walk around and squawk and everything. But if you fed it little pellets of food, it would kind of process the food and output it on the other end.
And
so the Parisian elite would sit around and, you know, marvel at this defecating duck. That's what they did for fun back then.
Well, and I think their doll – I'm not sure you can get dolls today that defecate, but I think they do wet their pants. So it's not completely far-fetched.
No, we're still doing the same thing.
As dolls and as human beings, apparently, as well. Well, let's take that short break and we'll get back to our conversation. Talking with Stephen Johnson in this hour of Radio Times. He's got a new book. It's called Wonderland, How Play Made the Modern World. And we have been talking about how inventions going back to Baghdad in the 8th century led through fits and starts to the creation and the use and the development of computers that we use today. We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. We'll be talking about musical instruments, about taverns and bars, and the Calico Madams after this very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen, and if you're just joining us, Stephen Johnson is our guest. We're talking about how fun and leisure and delight have led to innovations that have shaped our current age. And his book is called Wonderland, How Play Made the Modern World. I'm looking at your book, a bone flute from about 33,000 BCE. And you do have a section in here about why we make music and how making music, again, launched us, I guess, on this evolution into the creation of all sorts of technologies and things, again, that we use today. Why do we make music?
Yeah, well, I don't know if I entirely know the answer to that question, but it's a great mystery. And one of the things that we do know is that music has, from the beginning, been kind of directly tied to technology and innovation. You just think of the number of musical instruments that are out there and the number of musical instruments that were had been invented by, 1600. You had an entire orchestra of these instruments, some of the most kind of refined craftsmanship in the world devoted to music. And the bone flutes that I kind of opened that music chapter with, we think that they actually, there's some kind of debate about this, but they may be as old as 60,000 or 70,000 years old. People were making these flutes. And some of them, they believe, if you can see where the holes are positioned, and they think that they would have actually been able to produce musical intervals that we would recognize, like as a fifth and an octave and things like that, that a modern kind of Western listener would recognize as kind of musical tones. And we think drums are even older. They haven't stuck around as much because they're often made out of kind of animal skins and things like that. So drums are probably at least 100,000 years old. So this is very early in terms of the history of human beings, right? Right. This is way before we invented things like writing and the wheel and other objects, right? So the fact that our ancestors are sitting there at, kind of in Paleolithic times, they've got a whole world of tools to invent. They've made simple spears and maybe kind of sewing tools and things like that. What do they use their great ingenuity to invent next? They invent a flute, which seems like it should be a little bit lower on the list of priorities.
But it's not,
because there's something about that, the sound. And really, music is, this is the bizarre thing about it. Like, music is just mathematically interesting patterns of sound waves in our ears, right? An octave is just, kind of two waveforms that are kind of exactly double each other's frequency. And we don't know that math. We didn't understand that until, very recently. But there's something in our ears that say, oh, that sounds nice and kind of resonant and interesting. I wonder if I could make more devices that could make that sound. And so from the very beginning, the same thing with jewelry, right? Body ornaments are also as old as some of these music instruments and involve, craftsmanship and tools and things like that. And again, they serve no function. They're just beautiful. And so there is this very early interest in things that are just lovely or surprising or delightful that sparks our mind to kind of come up with new devices. And then we start inventing more elaborate instruments, and those instruments then lead us to more kind of traditionally serious innovations.
Well, what was interesting to me, and again, sort of fast forwarding, there's the development of the keyboards. Then right. You've got the typewriter, which was called the writing harpsichord, which kind of connects all the things that you just said.
Well, the typewriter, I'm really fascinated with this. Someday I'll write a little essay about this. I've been kind of collecting technologies that fit into this category. The typewriter is one of those technologies that seems to have been invented too late. In that we had all the technology we needed to make a typewriter in 1600 or 1700. And we had seen for at least 200 years from Gutenberg's success that if you invented a machine that allowed you to kind of arrange type in a convenient way, that there was money to be made from that. And yet the typewriter really isn't invented until the 1870s or 1880s. So it took – for some reason, it was hard for people to think of it. However, musical keyboards as opposed to alphanumeric keyboards are almost 2,000 years old. The Romans actually had musical keyboards in the organs that they used
water-powered organs, right? Water-powered organs. Wow.
Exactly. And the Banamusa, that's what they were – their instrument was a water-powered organ as well. I don't really understand what a water-powered organ is, so don't ask me about
that. It must be really big. That's all I can think of.
But they came up with this idea like, oh, if we want to trigger the notes, well, we've got these 10 independent functioning fingers. We could create a keyboard so that you could play multiple notes at the same time and all the things that you can do with a keyboard. And that organ keyboard then, got modified, turned into the clavichord and the harpsichord and then the pianoforte, which became the piano that we know today. And all of this goes on until finally, in 1860 or so, people start saying, well, wait a second, we could take this keyboard and modify it and actually have it create letters. And so the word key in keyboard is actually the legacy of that musical sense of the word key, that we kind of don't hear it anymore because we just think of keys as typewriter keys. But just think about – I mean, a keyboard is kind of a low-tech thing now. We have much more advanced technology. But think about how important the keyboard was to the digital revolution. Like, you can't – if you just tried to program a modern piece of software using punch cards, you would waste a lot of time, right? Being able to type is so much faster for inputting complicated instruction sets into a computer. So the typewriter, and then as it became a computer keyboard, is a big part of the computer revolution as well. And it too came directly out of music.
I have to say, I miss the sound of a typewriter or a bunch of typewriters in the newsroom. There is something almost musical the way a typewriter sounds or used to sound.
You can get your iPhone or your Android phone to simulate that sound.
I figure. Okay. Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Stephen Johnson, our guest in this hour of Radio Times, talking about his new book called Wonderland, How Play Made the Modern World, covering a lot of territory, a lot of time here as well. 1-888-477-9499. That's the number to call to join our conversation. And you can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. I mentioned that we're going to talk about the Calico Madams. Now, this takes us back to England. First of all, who were the Calico Madams?
Well, this is a story that is actually one of my favorite stories in the book, and it's one that's kind of directly relevant in a way to our current political situation. Yeah. So in the late 1600s, in England and parts of Europe, but particularly in London, well-to-do women got obsessed with this new exotic fabric that had come over from India. There were two kind of variations of it, calico and chintz. And these were cotton-based fabrics, and they were remarkable for a couple of reasons. One, they were cotton, and so that it was soft. As a fabric, and it could be worn as underwear in kind of the colder climates of the north, which was important because up until that point, people were wearing wool underwear. And you can imagine rainy, cold London
sure.
with wool underwear.
Scratchy.
Would not be fun.
No, not too fun.
So, but also, calico and chintz had these beautiful patterns that kind of dyers in India had figured out this elaborate technique for creating that were much more durable as patterns, so you could wash them multiple times and the pattern would stay, which was an innovation in and of itself. But again, just aesthetics, just beauty. It was just a beautiful pattern. So these well-to-do women start, both decorating their houses and then wearing garments and underwear with this exotic new fabric. And it sets off this really world-changing set of events. The first thing that happens is the East India Company makes famously a vast fortune importing these fabrics, and a huge trade deficit opens up with India. But what it also does is that it devastates the traditional wool industry, the local wool industry. And so there's this big backlash against these women and what you might call, using today's language, a kind of Make England's Wool Industry Great Again movement. And they start writing all these pamphlets and screeds and poems and plays against these women who are kind of shamed as they're called calico madams. And there's something about – there's an interesting kind of gender politics of this where something of their kind of sensual interest in these exotic overseas fabrics is destroying the British economy.
Kind of hussies.
And hussies? Yeah. I mean, it's basically – there's all this stuff that's really, really kind of – sexualized and misogynist on some level. And for a while, actually, the government actually bans calico and chintz altogether. They try to kind of stop the flow of these goods to protect the kind of native industries. But at the same time, another group of people start thinking, well, wait a second, maybe we could actually produce some of these fabrics and create these dyes ourselves here. And we could do it with new technology, maybe steam-powered technology that we're starting to understand better. And that literally is the birth of the Industrial Revolution. I mean, that is the Industrial Revolution was driven by textile machines, for most of the 1700s. And it was directly inspired by this appetite for cotton. And so when we – again, it's like the computers and music. When we tell the story of where did the Industrial Revolution come from, and when you read about that in your high school history textbook – it's almost always talked about in terms of, well, there were these great inventors and entrepreneurs who figured out how to build these wonderful machines that can, but while that is true, an important part of the story, again, the spark that began the whole process, the kind of prime mover behind the whole thing, when that set the wheels in motion, was his interest in this fabric and the kind of sensual, delightful, colorful patterns of calico and chintz. And if we don't tell that part of the story, we don't get it right.
Does it also lead to slavery and cotton plantations?
Yeah. So two big points here. One that we already kind of implicitly saw in the case of Baghdad, a lot of what Wonderland is about is, and the history of play is about globalization. Many of the stories are about, because logically, surprising, delightful things often come from other cultures. And so this interest in delight and amusement has, you know, from the very beginning, forced us to explore and experience new things and kind of remap the world in a way in pursuit of these interesting new experiences. So part of it is about globalization in the case of India and England in the case of calico. But the other point is that while these things are all fun and amusing, they have nonetheless led to some of the most atrocious periods of oppression or domination in the history of the world. And obviously you can't tell the history of cotton without telling the story of American slavery. I mean, if the market for cotton had not developed, you know, a lot of historians believe that slavery would have kind of collapsed under its own weight, at the turn of the 19th century, and you wouldn't have potentially had a civil war. But the cotton crop was so valuable to the South that they couldn't kind of get rid of this intensely immoral institution, and thus we had the Civil War. And so, you know, while this is in many ways a celebration of delight and play and amusement and how important that has been to us, it doesn't necessarily mean that it's entirely a story that always ends well.
Well, indeed. And I guess, you can follow something like this in along many different routes, because it could also lead to shopping malls or the department store, the hiring of women, and all the suffragette movement. I don't know how far afield you can go in connecting some of these dots or not.
Oh, I can go pretty far afield.
I figured you could. I don't know if we could follow you exactly.
Just try me. Well, you know, the other thing is just fashion. The creation of a kind of fashion industry and the rhythms of fashion, that's one of the things that kind of gets unleashed in the 18th century as well. And suddenly you have – basically over the course of the 1700s, fashion goes from something that happens on the scale of a decade. Like every 10 years there's kind of a new look. And you can just see it ramping up in speed over the course of that century. And it kind of – by the end of the 1700s, it kind of stops where it is now, which is like every year there's kind of a new look, right? And you can look at that and say, well, geez – doesn't that mean that people just wasted a lot of time trying to figure out if their, you know, frock was, you know, fashionable
in style or out of style?
Yeah, in style and en vogue in the current year, which is probably true. I mean, it does take up a lot of cycles to try and keep track of these things once they're changing so fast. But on the other hand, a lot of people, including Braudel, who's one of the great historians of this period, has argued that it's not an accident that the countries where fashion took hold and became a dominant part of the culture, like France, like England, to some extent like the United States, were also some of the cultures that had the earliest kind of political democratic revolutions, and that there was a sense in those societies where fashion created this openness to change and an idea that the old traditions and the way that things have always been done or the way that we've always looked is not necessarily the way it should be, and we can reinvent the way we look. And that created just a kind of sensibility that then got kind of transferred to more, I don't know, kind of traditional or, you know, powerful institutions, like what kind of government should we have. Yeah. And so I think there is a connection between democratization and fashion that it's not, you know, it's not a 100% connection, but I think it's powerful enough that it should be included in the story.
Well, let me make a little bit of a leap, and this is to games. You obviously, if we're talking about play and fun and delight, games, of course, play an important role in all of that. There was a popular game back in the 1840s called The Mansion of Happiness, and you include some of the rules, which I will read. Whoever possesses piety, honesty, temperance, gratitude, prudence, truth, chastity, sincerity is entitled to advance 6 numbers toward the mansion of happiness. Whoever gets into a passion must be taken to the water and have a ducking to cool him. Whoever possesses audacity, cruelty, immodesty, or ingratitude must return to his former situation till his turn comes to spin again and not even think of happiness, much less partake of it. So, as you say, kind of Cotton Mather meets a board game.
Sounds incredibly fun, doesn't it?
I was going to say, I'm not sure I would participate in that game. But nonetheless, I think it combines several of the things we've been talking about.
The early board games, particularly in America in that period, were very they really conceived of the game as a pedagogical tool in a sense. It was designed to teach people how to live, which is interesting because games have kind of come back now, and they're increasingly part of our school curriculum, hopefully not as austere as Mansion of Happiness. But they definitely had this idea that by playing the game that you could teach values, so you could convince children, you know, you could take these vulnerable children, get them to play a game, and they would learn, you know, how to behave or, you know, how to be moral or that. And then that actually led to this game created later in that century by this fascinating woman named Lizzie McGee called The Landlord's Game, which was a game designed specifically to teach very progressive, very left-wing economic theory. And it was all about how, you know, it was teaching the abuses of big real estate holders and real estate monopolies. And she specifically designed it as a game to teach kids that they should be good left-wing progressives and resist these big monopolies. And that game got kind of stolen years later and remodified, and it became Monopoly, which is the exact opposite. It's like a celebration of capitalism and all of its excitement. And she, you know, poor Lizzie McGee has kind of been written out of the history, both her original vision for the game and her role in creating it.
That's Stephen Johnson, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. We're talking about his new book, Wonderland, How Play Made the Modern World, covering a lot of territory. And got calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. We'll be talking about coffee houses and taverns. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowing, talking with Stephen Johnson. He's written a number of books, including Where Good Ideas Come From, Future Perfect, Everything Bad is Good for You, How We Got to Now, which was developed into a PBS series. And we've been talking about his new book, Wonderland, How Play Made the Modern World. Let me get Gretchen from Philadelphia to join our conversation. Hi, Gretchen. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I was wondering what Stephen's reaction to is to the heavy focus that the United States has on employment and productivity and the lack of emphasis and sometimes shame that's placed on play and leisure. I'm a recreational therapy researcher, and I find that for people who experience disabilities, treatment and community integration often focuses predominantly on work. And I find that we have a growing adult population that doesn't know how to play. Is there a concern that we may lose development and creativity as less emphasis is placed on play and leisure?
Gretchen, it's a great question. Stephen, let me give you a chance to respond.
Yeah, I mean, as you might imagine, I completely agree with what the premise of the question. I think there's the hopeful sign here is that if you go – in fact, we did a podcast episode. We've got a kind of podcast that accompanies the book, and we went and looked at some workspaces that are generally kind of like high-tech workspaces like Etsy, the kind of artisanal shopping site, and
sure.
Zappos, the shoe place. If you go to any of the like high-tech companies, Google, their campuses and so on, they're immensely playful environments, and they understand that to be creative, to be innovative, you have to create an environment. It can't just be sitting there like with your slog, you know, trying to, you know, can't be that kind of factory structure. It has to be an environment where the brain has time to go through that kind of exploratory kind of delight of play to get to new ideas. And so I'm hoping that, you know, since we all seem to agree that at least the one thing we agree about the economy is that the tech sector has – been the envy of the world and is doing incredibly well, and we would like all of our industries to be doing as well as the tech sector is. Maybe we should look at that and say, well, you know, the playful nature of those spaces, those offices, those campuses is not just a perk that they have. It's one of the reasons why they're so successful. And so we need to bring that into our workspaces. But also, I think what also is being suggested in the question is just to validate that part of our lives, right? That, you know, why do we bother doing any of this if,
sure.
if we don't have time to enjoy and amuse ourselves? And it's not just a feeling of, you know, being self-indulgent. It's like we should be crafting a society where people have more time to play and experience these things, particularly as families with our kids. It's a great – I mean, you know, when we have – one of the things I always say about the video game question with kids is that, you know, the best thing to do is to try and play one of these games with your kid. Because
and it's hard. I've tried.
It's hard because
yes.
– and what you get out of it is one, it's just a great exercise. It's fun. It's particularly fun because the kid is the expert, right? The kid knows the game way more than you do. And so they're in this mode of like, let me tell you how to play this game, Dad. You're really terrible at it, but I can teach you, which is a great mode for an 11-year-old to be in with their parent in a way. And you as the parent then get an appreciation for the complexity of the kind of problem solving that they're doing in the game rather than just seeing it as this great kind of time waste.
Gretchen, I appreciate the call to Radio Time. Stephen, let me quote you. You write in your book, you will find the future wherever people are having the most fun. You stand by that?
I do. Ironically, I should confess that that's the one line my editor was writing kind of jacket description for the book, and she kind of came up with a line for the jacket description. And I was like, that's a great line, Courtney. So I took it and
you
put it into the
and
book.
Stole it. Yes.
And now it's like the line everybody quotes. So, you know, whatever. I should just hand over the reins entirely to Courtney
right.
Young.
Trademark.
But yeah, this is the thing. If think about it, if you were sitting there in 1750 trying to figure out what were the big changes coming to society over the next 200 years from automation and industrialization and computation computers and maybe even artificial intelligence and robots and all this big stuff that was coming, the best clue to that future would have been that digesting duck in Paris, you know, this little automaton that was pretending to be alive and that was programmable and all these different things that we've talked about over the course of this hour. And that is often the case when we look at – same thing with Baghdad. If we went to the House of Wisdom, we would have seen a lot of the future there, but it would have looked like toys. It would have looked like amusement. And so when we're trying to figure out what's coming next, oftentimes what people are doing at the edge of their experiences in a non-directly functional way but in a kind of amusement or kind of delight-driven way, that ends up being the seeds of more kind of serious revolutions to come.
I was thinking when we got our call about she was focusing on the workplace, but one has to think about schools that get rid of recess or are removing gym classes or art classes. I mean, some of it is because of financial problems or the lack of finances, but it does seem giving up all that stuff, we're going to pay a big price for that.
Yeah, it's one of the reasons why I think, you know, the big push on to, you know, STEM education, I think that the STEAM modification of STEM where there's arts in there is, I think, a useful corrective and trying to, you know, just thinking about music alone in this story, how important it is. So I'm trying to remind people that there is a you know, there is a playful, creative, imaginative, artistic side to science, technology, engineering, and math. And in the long run, if we lose that playfulness, we'll suffer.
Mm-hmm. I mean, maybe STEAM is a better – rather than STEM, add the A for arts, and maybe that's a little more inclusive. Well, let's talk a little bit about coffee houses and taverns or bars. And you write about the role that they played in helping to foment revolution, the Enlightenment, civil rights movements. How much of that do you think is just the fact that people are there together, they have time to talk, and how much of it is it because of alcohol and caffeine?
I don't know if I could do an exact breakdown. It's clearly a mix of both. But just, you know, that's kind of the last chapter of the book, and it's really trying to say that sometimes – sometimes innovations look like technology. They look like, oh, that's a little automated flute player. It looks like a little robot. That's an innovation. But sometimes innovations are something a little kind of lower tech, like a space, an institution, like a coffee house or a tavern. Someone had to invent the idea of a bar, right? A place that was designated as a place you would go to have some alcohol and hang out with people that was not work. It was not, you know, the farm. It was not the factory. It was not home. It was not a church. It was this other kind of interesting space where there was some booze. And then later on, we kind of invented coffee houses and tea houses and things like that for kind of different drugs to be consumed. But the creation of those kinds of spaces where you go to hang out and to unwind and it's a little informal and you have conversations with folks and you meet folks and the kind of social barriers are lowered a bit, in part because of the booze and in part because of the kind of nature of the space itself. That was an extraordinary invention. And if you look again, if you go back through history, coffee houses were central to the British Enlightenment, which I've now written about in like 4 different books. I keep coming back to that story because it's such an interesting one.
It is.
But the tavern, I mean, think about Philadelphia. The tavern was a central kind of institution in the American Revolution. You cannot tell the story of the kind of the defeat of the British without talking about the kind of social network that was created by these taverns. The taverns were the places where the Declaration of Independence was read aloud and common sense was read aloud. And you know, it is probable that the American Revolution would have happened had taverns not been invented, but it would have required a different kind of social space for those people and those ideas to come together. And so it's a big – and same thing for the gay rights movement, right? Think of how important bars are to the history of gay liberation movements from Stonewall to the Black Cat. Those were places where people were liberated somewhat by the alcohol and by the kind of semi-private, semi-public nature of a bar to take on an identity that was otherwise not, you know, allowed in society. And so the invention of that space was extremely important to our social and political history.
Let me see what Susan from Northeast Philadelphia has to say. And Susan, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Good morning.
Good morning.
My parents would socialize all the time around games, playing bridge. My father would play pinochle with the guys. My mother would play Scrabble with her girlfriends. And I'm 65, but my friends don't do that.
What do they do?
They don't. We see each other, but we it's not around games. And you know, the getting together to play a game was central to why they got together. So, do you see that maybe the way people are relating to each other has changed?
What do you think, Stephen? Thanks, Susan, for the call.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, we are seeing more and more. There, obviously, games. If you include games happening on screens now, mm-hmm. there's been a tremendous kind of return to games. And there is an interesting kind of revival of board games that has happened. I don't know if it's happening in kind of older generations, but the younger generations are actually playing a lot of board games. But it is a lovely kind of bonding experience. Our kids, we all learned bridge about 3 years ago, and we've started playing bridge as a family, which is super fun. But the other thing that we should mention that I wrote a little piece about this actually that's on Medium is I went through this whole project with my then 9-year-old son where we designed a board game from scratch, and that is an amazing exercise and this is something that should be in every classroom as a part of the curriculum, because the process of coming up with a game, figuring out what the metaphor of the game is, whether you're trying to teach radical, you know, progressive politics
or get subverted, whatever it is. Right.
Thinking about the statistical probability of the game, do you're using a spinner or dice or cards or whatever it is, what are the rules, and you dream up this whole system, and in doing that you have to predict what will happen once you start playing, and you come up with all these different variables. And it's such a creative kind of way of thinking. And then you play the game for the first time and the game is terrible. You know, it's boring or it's not – there's no strategy or you always get stuck in one part of the board and it surprises you in some way. And so then you have to revise your prediction, your hypothesis about the game, make it better, improve it, try it again. this is the scientific method, right? This is the whole process. If you build a hypothesis about how this system is going to work, and then you test that hypothesis, and then you revise that hypothesis based on the feedback, that is a very rich form of kind of creative and analytic thinking. And yet, if you do it with a 9-year-old in the form of a game, they will have no idea that they are learning this very rich form of thinking. They will just want to do this all day long because it's a game and they're doing it with dad. So I think that that's been one of the great kind of experiences as a parent. I really encourage people to do it and think about it as a classroom exercise as well.
Were you, as a kid, were you a good player? I mean, I don't mean that. I think all kids are in their own way. But were you a kid that had, I don't know, games that you played or friends you played with or imaginary friends? Or
now we're going to get into the deep psychology of this all. I'm going to sit back on the couch here. No,
Well, what ahead.
I did was I did love playing games, but I started playing these dice baseball games because this is kind of right before video games really took off. This is the 70s. And so you would play these games where you could simulate professional baseball. You had cards for all the players and they'd mathematically modeled the players and you would pick your lineup and you play. But then I got obsessed with designing more accurate baseball games.
Oh, really?
Based on dice. And so I designed probably 10 different kind of separate baseball games that would include the size of the stadium or like the winds or, you know, all these different things to make them more and more accurate. And the problem was no one would play these games with me. I would just sit in my room alone playing these games because they were too complicated and no one wanted to learn this crazy system that I'd scratched out on a legal pad. And so I would just play both sides of the game by myself. And so it's
a sad story, really.
I'm just compensating. I'm justifying all those
this
years that I
wasted
my writing.
This explains your entire adult career and all the things that you've written
to make
up for that.
Now we know.
Well, quoting you again or quoting your publicist again, you will find the future wherever people are having the most fun. So where today are most people having the most fun?
Well, look, great example of this, you know, really happened after I'd finished the draft of the book, which was this summer with Pokemon Go, last summer. You know, there we have this, you know, the first real kind of augmented reality experience where people are walking around the world getting information from their computer that's added onto a screen that's showing them the real world supplemented with this other information. And they were doing it to capture imaginary monsters or whatever the Pokemon are.
I never quite figured that out, but yes, go ahead.
But it was amazing. It was great for our family because our kids just wanted to go run around all day long and explore our little town where we live in the summer which they never want to do. So got them outside. But that, I think, we'll look back 10 years from now as we're, you know, when we all have devices that are kind of doing that for us all the time through glasses or whatever we're wearing. And we'll say, oh, this started with a game.
Are you working on another book?
I'm working on two other books. I'm working on one book that I've almost finished about long-term decision making. And that will come out sometime next year, I think. And then I'm writing another historical book about a pirate. A true story about a pirate. That's all I'll say, but it's a good story.
Well, who doesn't want to read a story about a pirate?
I know, that's what I'm thinking.
Well, Stephen Johnson, always a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Yeah, my pleasure.
And Stephen Johnson, author of Wonderland, How Play Made the Modern World. And again, his other books include Where Good Ideas Come From, Future Perfect, Everything Bad is Good for You, How We Got to Now. And I should add that he mentioned this. Wonderland is also a multi-platform project that includes a podcast. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes and you can find out more about this program, including how to download our podcast of the program. I'm Marty Moscone. Thanks for joining us.